It's Wednesday, January the 12th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. I think it's safe to say at this point that we are definitively into 2022, but it's also true that there's great uncertainty still remaining around what lies ahead in the immediate future as the Omicron variant of COVID-19 sweeps across the country with extraordinary and unprecedented numbers of infections reported daily. So what does that all mean from a political perspective? Jennifer Bray and Harry McGee from our political staff are here to discuss the road ahead. Happy New Year to you both.
Hi, Hugh.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year to you and all of our few, many listeners.
Many, not the few, in 2022. In our case, Jen.
Yeah.
Let me go to you first with what is really the top news line item this morning, on Wednesday morning, which is that the government is considering recommendations from Tony Holohan on easing the restrictions on close contacts of people who have tested positive for COVID, Jen.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here. The first thing is, so this is all coming on foot of, firstly, recommendations from the ECDC over the weekend, and secondly, then on foot of those, a letter from Tony Holohan to Stephen Donnelly yesterday afternoon. And in that letter, he makes a number of recommendations. The first one, I suppose, is that, and this will have a really big impact on the testing system, they hope, is that previously, if you had, remember over Christmas, the rules change and they're changing all the time. Nobody can really keep up with them. But if you had a positive antigen test, you need to go get that confirmed with a confirmatory PCR test. Now they've changed it so that if you have a positive antigen test, that is enough for you to basically be declared as having COVID-19. So what that effectively means is that previously, it was the case that the only people who could go and get a PCR test if they got the positive antigen were people who were over the age of 40, young kids or healthcare workers. And this basically really frees up massive capacity in the testing system because we know that it's currently operating at surge capacity, which means at the very upper limits of its reach and beyond, and that we have capacity for between antigens and PCR 650,000 tests a week. So what they're hoping is this eases up the pressure and that the people who need to get PCR tests the most will be able to get them. And the second change that is made, that's going to be inflated a little bit, this will be confirmed by the Cabinet, and this is the change to the isolation rule. So basically what that means is that if you are a close contact of a confirmed case of COVID-19 and you have had your booster, previously you had to isolate for 5 days. That's being done away with now. And the hope here is that this will relieve like a huge amount of the pressure in all different walks of life, all different sectors, whether it be in hospitals, whether it be in hospitality, teachers, guards, wherever, whatever job you're working in, that this will mean that you won't be out of action for those 5 days if you've been boosted. But of course, on the proviso that you don't have any symptoms. The other change, I suppose, then if you are a close contact of a confirmed case of COVID-19, but you haven't had your booster shot, you'll now have to isolate or self-restrict your movements for 7 days. The final change then is if you yourself have got COVID-19, and previously it was the case that people who had a booster shot had to restrict their movements for isolate for 7 days, and that people who hadn't a booster, that was 10 days. That's now going to be reduced for 7 days for everyone. So anyone who gets COVID, booster or not, it's 7 days. And then the close contacts, restriction of your movements if you've been boosted, 7 days if you haven't. So they're the main changes that have been agreed.
So if I could ask you, there's a couple of things that strike me about that. One is that there's ample space for confusion here with all these changes and these different kinds of groups of people who are required to act in different ways. And I'm sure there will be some confusion. But the other one is that, the kind of dialectic up to now has been that you have the health authorities recommending stricter guidelines and government pushing back to some extent because they have a broader range of concerns that they need to represent, for example, economic ones. But in this case, this relaxation, which seems to me to be designed to help keep schools open, hospitals running, shops open, all those kinds of things, is actually coming from Tony Holohan and therefore maybe seems to suggest that the health authorities are relatively sanguine about where this is all going, despite the huge positive numbers at the moment.
Yeah, I would agree. And, it's so interesting, previously when we had even the smallest of increases and spikes, it was kind of a cause for alarm. I think you remember last year we were suddenly, 1 week we were turning a corner into beating this thing, and the next week we were talking about restrictions, and that's how quickly things moved. And, I think if you had told people at the start of the pandemic that, I remember a day when there was 123, I think, cases notified, and everybody got a bit like, oh my God, 123 cases. yesterday there was a headline in our paper that up to 500,000 people could have contracted COVID-19 last week. And people just kind of said, oh, God, well, anyway, you know, it's an incredible journey and distance that we've come. And it's not just us, exactly like you point out, the NPHET and the health experts. So, you know, it's interesting. I read their letter, latest letter to government, which they sent, Tony Holohan sent last Thursday, and it went up online yesterday. And they talk about how dire the situation is in terms of case numbers, in terms of the pressure on the testing system, in terms of staff absences from the health service and the extreme pressure there. And then they reference the most important part, which has always been the most important part, which is the fact that the level of hospitalizations and the level of admissions to intensive care units has, as they say in the letter, is actually remaining relatively stable. And that's the key, I think. That's the reason why this is different to all the previous times. It's because it would appear, nobody wants to say 100% that the link between rising cases and hospitalizations has been broken, but it really does look that way. And that's why we're in a position where the panic button isn't being pressed at the moment, I think.
Harry, do you agree with that? We seem to be in a very, very different period of the pandemic now than we were even 3 months ago, much less at the start of it.
Oh yeah, for sure. There's no doubt about that at all, Hugh. If you look at the cases are reaching record levels each day. Yet people, I'm not saying that they're blasé about it, but people are far less concerned than they have been previously. And of course, there are reasons for that. We know that this particular variant seems to be much milder than Delta and previous variants. That's borne out by the figures. That you always think there's going to be a lagging effect when case numbers are published. But we have extraordinarily high case numbers, above 20,000 every day. We have 1,000 people in hospital and we can't try to diminish that in terms of its importance. But then when you look at the figure in relation to intensive care units, you're talking about 92 people in total in ICU. And that number has remained consistent over the past week. And the experience from elsewhere has shown us that despite the very high case numbers in South Africa in particular, the number of hospitalizations and the number of deaths and the number of serious illnesses were very, very small in comparison to earlier variants. Now, there are caveats to that. Of course, the population of South Africa is younger than the population of most European countries, including Ireland. But I mean, the net point is that, you know, I mean, the common cold started off life as a coronavirus. And I'm sure hundreds and hundreds of years ago, before it mutated, it probably was lethal. But then it became successful as a virus and spread. And the more successful the virus becomes, the lesser its virulence or its impact. Politically, we're seeing extraordinary phenomena as well. We're seeing Tony Holohan in the guise of a good cop as opposed to bad cop. It's only a couple of weeks ago when he was telling people not to do any Christmas shopping or any post-Christmas shopping because of fears of the virus spreading. And a fortnight later, he is agreeing to a relaxation of isolation periods, as outlined by Jen there, that are even more liberal than those of the European Disease Control Centre, which is extraordinary as well. And just, I mean, the key to all of this, of course, is the vaccinations. The vaccination programmes have been successful. Most people have now got their boosters. They're moving on to kids. And my own daughter is getting her vaccine tomorrow. And it looks like most kids between 5 and 12 will be vaccinated over the next couple of weeks. So we will have a high national rate of protection against COVID. And as well as that, 500,000 people getting the virus and not suffering, most of them not suffering any untoward consequences, will mean that the protection from the virus is heightened even more because of the natural antibodies that they will be containing. So even though we're in reaching the peak of this particular wave, the concern levels are so low in comparison to previous waves of COVID-19.
That said, there are potential pitfalls. There always are political pitfalls for the government in particular, Jen. It strikes me two of them are, first of all, in relation to costs, which people are being asked to bear themselves, whether it be the antigen tests, which they're now taking. When you went for a PCR test, the state covered the cost, and now you're being told to take an antigen test instead. And those do cost money, as we know. And those costs can mount up in a household, particularly if that household is not particularly well off. And there doesn't seem to be any... they are being sent out to people, but otherwise people have to buy them themselves. They're sent out to people if they request them because of symptoms, but asymptomatic people still have to pay for them themselves. And the other one is there is a recommendation for using higher grade masks in certain contexts, and those masks themselves also carry costs as well. So there might be some pushback on that. But the bigger question I wonder about is there's bound to be pressure as we get to, there is a key date at the end of January when the state decides what comes next. And there's questions about pubs and restaurants and Six Nations rugby and all kinds of things on which decisions will have to be made. And those might be quite fraught.
You're right. Yeah. Like it's all well and good saying, OK, we're in a position now where the National Public Health Emergency Team has said, don't change any of these restrictions until the end of January, which is what they said. And we've seen in the past the politicians, sometimes they can take cover in that. You know, they can say, well, this is the recommendation from the team. And, you know, we haven't reached the peak yet. And only a fool would start relaxing restrictions before we've got there. So that's the pattern they're in now. But you're right, like that will change really quickly. You know, if the modelling proves correct, we could see like a drastic plummeting of cases towards the end of January and into early February. And that's when the pressure really comes on. Now, it's definitely the case that the pressure is already on ministers. I've spoken to ministers, and it's not just that they, you know, have publicans in their ear, or, you know, restaurants, cinemas, you name it, anything that used to be open after 8 p.m. effectively, you know, sports, outdoor sports, all that kind of stuff. It's also the cost of it, like you said, generally to the political system. They have that on their mind. They are under pressure. But there's a lot of them who actually also believe that the science behind stuff like the 8 p.m. closing is dubious. And they say this kind of privately. They're not saying it publicly yet, but I don't think it will be long until they do. I would give it 2 weeks. And I think that's when you will see a change in those rules. I do know that there are a lot of ministers who believe that when we get to the point when we've got, you know, after the peak, and we start to have that conversation about removing the partial restrictions that we have, that we shouldn't be a country that is, you know, overly cautious. They want to be. There's many ministers said to me that we've been a laggard, basically, in comparison to European counterparts, and that when it comes to the time, we shouldn't hang around. We should say, OK, this is gone, that is gone, this is gone, and we're getting back to whatever kind of normality we can. So, yeah, I think we'll see a little bit more. I think it's just a little bit too early for them to go there until the Omicron wave peaks, which they don't quite know when it'll happen. It's either happening now or happen later in the week. So we'll have to wait and see. And the other thing I would say is, politically, you mentioned antigen tests. Yes, Sinn Féin are already out saying that if the new rules say that you only need antigen tests and you're not going to get a PCR test, and that's what you need to tell your employer, et cetera, that you have COVID-19, then it should be subsidised by the state. And I think this will become a really big issue today, tomorrow and into next week. And the final thing I would say, if people are confused about the new rules, I don't know whether this works for anybody and it will probably change next week, but I just think about 007 77. Okay, so no confirmatory test, no isolation period if you've had your booster, you're a close contact. 7 days if you have had a boost, you haven't had a booster and you're a close contact, and then 7 days if you've COVID booster, and 7 days if you've COVID without a booster. 00 00 77 77. Is that right?
Very interesting. That replaces the RSVP that we had at Christmas. This could be the new marketing push by Neffet, isn't it?
Look, it'll only be in place for a week, so, but it might be helpful.
Harry, can I ask you, with all this COVID stuff still going on and seemingly not going away in the immediate future, where is normal politics? I mean, the Dáil returns next week. Is there much of a legislative agenda that the government will be pushing through over the successive months? I mean, it seems to have gone off the radar entirely.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Normal politics is continuing to kind of trundle along. I think over the past number of years, one issue has tended to dominate the agenda. Before COVID, of course, it was Brexit that dominated everything for about 3 or 4 years, and it's still there, but it doesn't. It's not where it was once COVID came along. But there is a lot. I mean, the government did get a fair amount of legislation through the Dáil in 2021, despite all the restrictions. The Dáil has returned to its kind of normal sitting hours. The committees are back in full flow, so there's actually quite a big agenda of work, and all the kind of the limits that we saw imposed in 2020 have more or less gone away. So I think that during 2022, we will see far more of that, the kind of the mundane and the quotidian politics being played out, very tedious legislation being debated even more tediously in the Dáil, being kind of scrutinised line by line committee. And if you look at the programme for government, notwithstanding that it was drafted during the middle of the first COVID wave. It's quite ambitious in relation to the legislation and the kind of policy platform it has set out for itself. And I expect more of that to happen during the course of this year. Just in terms of politics, one of the things that struck me during this week that was kind of interesting was that it went to one of the old tropes or one of the old themes in politics about one rule for the privileged and another rule for the hoi polloi, for the ordinary person. It hasn't really been played out in Ireland this week, but in Westminster we see what's happening with Boris Johnson at present with the so-called party that took place in Downing Street and the controversy in Australia over Novak Djokovic and his visa to play in the Australian Open. Are resonant of themes that we've seen over many years in Irish politics and elsewhere. People really hate when people get privileges. They really hate when politicians begin feathering their own nests. They really hate when one rule is drafted for those in a position of privilege and there's another rule for everybody else. And we've seen those themes feature very strongly over the past couple of days. And I'm sure those themes will find a place to be played out in Irish politics over the next couple of months as well.
Indeed. And of course, we've had our incidents. And in fact, you know, some of them, the Golfgate related ones, are before the courts as we speak. But we don't seem to have the absolute, you know, political turmoil which is happening across the water arising out of Boris Johnson's activities almost 2 years ago now, we should remember, at the height of the first wave of the pandemic. But I do still wonder, Jen, about politics. I mean, this government, we're a year and a half into this government now, and there's been a lot of focus on, you know, the usual, the intra-party tensions, you know, the leaders, the state of the polls, that kind of thing. But, you know, some Irish governments are quite activist and their record is quite strong in terms of legislation. Some aren't. The last one, for example, I think it's fair to say wasn't in its last couple of years. Didn't seem to be doing a lot, was just getting through the Brexit experience. This, as Harry says, this it has quite a, you know, quite a full agenda of things that it claims to want to do over the next 2 years.
Yeah, I would agree. If you remember, it was 2016, 17, 18-ish when the phrase "do nothing doll" was bandied around an awful lot. I think it's because of the minority government and the fact that it was much more difficult for the government to get bills through, given that they kind of tacitly had to be run by Fianna Fáil, and that had its problems. And there's been a couple of reforms since then, you know, things like pre-legislative scrutiny, it's basically a clearinghouse, which has changed things. And I do think that this year will be different because hopefully nobody knows, like Harry said, what's going to happen with Omicron or COVID. But hopefully this is us now finally learning to you know, finding a way to live with it, which means that other politics can have space to breathe again. And I have a feeling that this is going to be a year of greater regulation, in that if we look at what's on the pipeline, you know, Catherine Martin, for example, she will be pushing forward a bill on online safety media regulation. This will see the first media commissioner set up to regulate the media landscape for the first time. That'll be really interesting to see what their remit will be, what power they have in relation to social media companies, whether it makes any difference. If you then think about justice, you have the promise of the first gambling regulator, long overdue. Or some of our gambling laws go back to the 20s and 30s. You know, they're arcane. And the pledge has been that we will see this person, this first gambling regulator and the commission set up for the first time this year. And both of those things will be really, really important, tangible things that could actually make a difference to people's lives. You know, people whose families have been absolutely devastated by gambling and there is no recourse for any kind of proper help from the state. So, you know, when I think about the year ahead, I imagine those are the things that have been promised for decades. And if they can get those big ticket items through, I think they'll be doing quite well.
I wanted to ask you about something else, which is not on the national politics scale, but on the other hand, it might do, because it might have ramifications. It's an unusual case involving the Standards and Public Office, who have censured a Monaghan councillor. His name is Seamus Traynor, for the content of the leaflets which he sent out, or his campaign sent out, during the 2019 election. It's sort of unprecedented. And when I saw this story, first of all, I thought, this is unusual and perhaps should be receiving more attention, that a state body is in a position to take action against campaign statements, essentially, by somebody running for democratic office. Could you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, so basically this is the result of an investigation by SIPO that they released the details of, I think it was late last week. And basically the Standards and Public Office Commission, what they found was that it was an election leaflet, which was issued by an independent councillor in Monaghan. His name, like you said, his name's Councillor Seamus Traynor. This was before the 2019 local elections. And what they found was that this leaflet breached the Code of Conduct for Councillors and the Ethics in Public Office Act. And I do think it's important to mention those two things because obviously they're the grounds under which this decision and these findings were made. And if we get into the detail of what the alleged problems were when they were, basically it was complaints that went into the council from the public, I believe, and which were then brought to SIPO. So the first one was that it was factually incorrect. This is the what they call statement of alleged contraventions. That it was, number one, this is in the commission's report, that it was factually incorrect and misleading to say in his leaflet that 92% of asylum seekers are, quote, deemed to be bogus. The second was that it was legally incorrect to claim that EU migrants could claim benefits after only 72 hours in Ireland. And the third alleged contravention in the report was that it was factually incorrect and misleading to say that there were 22 economic migrants that were housed in the county upon the instruction of the Department of Justice. So what the findings were of the commission, they were actually really strong, and I might just go through one or two of them. They found that on the first one in relation to bogus claims from refugees trying to get into the country, they found that the Councillor Traynor deliberately adopted emotive, open-ended and accusatory language without reference to sources or evidence. They also said that a statement that someone entering the country from another EU member state can claim benefits for 72 hours was on evidence from their own evidence from a legal advisor to the commission, was without foundation and calculated to denigrate and anger. And then they found that the councillor's objection to this 22 houses, basically to economic migrants, I think was the phrase that he used in the leaflet, they said on evidence that is shown to be inaccurate and that it had the effect of demonising an identifiable group of people, and also had the effect of generating a sense of grievance amongst other groups of people. And they found this inaccuracy to be particularly egregious and caused an inflammatory creation of a them versus us narrative. So that they were their findings. I think you can agree, like they're quite strong. I think the question maybe that will be asked possibly is around the right of free speech for an elected representative. And I'm happy to go into that with you. But one thing I will say before that is that in the hearings, which I read a transcript of in 2 a.m, because sometimes insomnia will get you. But in the transcript of those hearings, the counsel or the legal representative for the councillor, Monaghan, said that he didn't believe that comments that are made during canvassing come under the basically the rules that councillors are supposed to be held under. And it was the commission's argument that when you're canvassing, you're very much canvassing with, you know, the aim of being a councillor. You're talking about the work you're going to do. And also, if you can just say, well, that was, I only said that when I was canvassing, then it would undermine the entire code, because you could just say you were canvassing at any time you said something that was potentially inaccurate. So they said they weren't going to go there.
Okay, well, just to understand one practicality element of that then, if he had not been a councillor at the time but had been running for the council, he wouldn't have been subject to these regulations, because this was because of his behaviour at a time when he was a councillor.
Yeah, but what the commission seemed to be saying is that regardless of that, if you are undertaking work that is aimed at that kind of, you know, being a councillor or work of the council or work of a local authority, then that will be, you should come under the remit of that councillor's code of conduct and those other relevant. It's a really interesting one, and they had an argument about it, and the commission came down one way. I think it will be interesting in future if it did turn out that stuff you said when you were canvassing didn't count, because then we're in for some interesting elections, I think.
Well, it would, but these are not regulations which have been tested in this way before. And Harry, the one thing that strikes me listening to that is, and obviously, you know, some of this debate, and I should say personally, first of all, I think it was pretty appalling nonsense, garbage that this councillor published in his election literature. That's my own personal view. But some of the things he was found guilty of doing, I'm just looking at what Jen was saying there, you know, using accusatory and emotive language, playing on a sense of grievance, using a notion of us versus them. Is that not what a huge amount of political discourse and campaigning does most of the time?
Absolutely. I think you have to distinguish between two different concepts, one which is easier to deal with, the other one which is more problematic The one that's easier to deal with is what is fact and what is fiction. And it was clear that some of his literature was not borne out by evidence. You know, he was talking about 92% of those who come in are bogus asylum seekers. And that wasn't true. And I mean, there will always be some people who come in who have no status in terms of the asylum claims that they made. But the 92% figure wasn't borne out by any evidence. And then you get to the second issue, which is more problematic. You know, what language and what kind of tone can one use in terms of one's literature? And for example, can one use the word bogus, for example? You know, and it could be argued that that could be used, but it might be kind of marginal. I think when the tone becomes accusatory, or when the language is deliberately used to denigrate somebody or a class of people, it's then that you get into the kind of the area, you know, of the limits of free speech.
But we do have other, we have legislation about hate speech and various other things. This is separate to that.
It is, but I mean, it's the same runes, as it were, the same kind of concepts that you're dealing with. You know, what language can you, is there a limit to the language that one can use? Is there a limit to the claims that one can use? And there is a balance to be struck between somebody being allowed to make a robust claim that you wouldn't agree with, or to project a philosophy or a political standpoint that you would be diametrically opposed to. But I think there is a tipping point, as it were, when language becomes inflammatory, when language becomes used as a vehicle to foment violence, or to deliberately become incendiary. And it's just trying to find the limit of that language that becomes problematic, in my view.
No, I think that's a fair point. Finally, on this, I just observe myself that the questions of boundaries of speech are always very important, and they always do fluctuate slightly. And this case, it seems to me, is a new element which has been introduced into the regulation of Irish political discourse, and it deserves to be considered and debated rather than just accepted or indeed rejected. Listen, the last point I wanted to come to you, Harry, because we're out of Christmas now, but a mainstay of the Christmas newspapers and the Christmas Irish Times is the state papers, the archive papers, which are released at the end of each year. And you had the agreeable or disagreeable task of ploughing through those this year, without going into the detail, because it's all there for people to read, and so much of it is fascinating because they cover a very interesting period in Irish political history and Anglo-Irish relations, the 1990s. How does it all work? And I was very confused reading some of these pieces because they seem to cover different time periods, the different pieces from the British and Irish archives. I got a bit confused about what the rules were and what was being released. Can you kind of clarify that for me?
Yeah, well, there was a change of rules this year, Hugh. Previously, it was quite simple. I mean, once a confidential government document was generated, if there was ruendangen or confidentiality for a period of 30 years. And after 30 years, the seal of confidentiality was broken and those records were transferred to the National Archive, which made them available for public viewing. So in the old system, 2021 was last December. All the documents from 1991 would have been released. That's when Charlie Haughey was in his last year as Taoiseach, and when John Major had just recently taken over from Margaret Thatcher. But a couple of years ago, the British changed the rules on their side, and they began gradually to reduce that period of confidentiality from 30 years down to 20 years. So what happened then was that we were a couple of years behind, and an increasing number of years behind each year. And the why that's important is that historical events that happened, for example, in the middle 1990s, we were getting the British perspective on them, but not getting any Irish perspective, and no prospect of getting an Irish perspective for another 5 or 6 years. So a decision was made over the past year that we'd catch up with the British this year. So what happened at Christmas was that we didn't just have a release of 1 year of Anglo-Irish documents. We had a release of 7 years covering the time span between 1991 and 1998. And that was like a huge undertaking for media organisations. And for the first time ever, all the media organisations had to operate a pool system where each media organisation took 1 or 2 years and then shared the fruits of our research at the end of a very, very intensive week. So that's why it was a little bit confusing, because we just didn't have 1 year this year, but we had actually 1991 to 1998, covering the Haughey era right to Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair and the Good Friday Agreement and what have you.
And are those papers solely relating to Anglo-Irish relations? For example, what about all the other documentation? Because, you know, there was a lot of very interesting stuff happened in those Haughey, Reynolds, Bruton years of the 1990s.
Yeah, I mean, most of the records from the Department of the Taoiseach, which covers the leader, are released. And most of the Anglo-Irish papers were released. But because of COVID restrictions and because of the huge volume of material that would be involved over the course of 7 years, they're gradually releasing the papers from other government departments over the coming months and years. I mean, to do everything from 7 years over the course of 1 year would have been an impossible task for the National Archive and from everybody else. And because of COVID restrictions, of course, access to some of the documents in government departments was more problematic, and they weren't able to transfer all documents to the National Archive this year. So we got Anglo-Irish, essentially, Taoiseach and Foreign Affairs, Department of Justice, Attorney General and the President's Office, I think, for 7 or 8 years. But the rest of is going to follow, I think, over the next 12 months or 24 months.
And then just explain to me, how does it work? Are these hard copies? Are these physical documents? Do you go in like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible with your camera at the ready, click, 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 take pictures of all the pages? Or is there some electronic thing?
Absolutely. There are big manila folders with thousands of documents. I mean, talk about angels dancing on the head of a pin as people sweated over decommissioning in the run-up to the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, thousands of pages to-ing and fro-ing in relation to decommissioning, North-South ministerial councils, whether the UUP would talk to Sinn Féin, whether Sinn Féin would actually be invited to talks. So you wade through thousands of documents. And the only way that you can actually take a record is by just using your phone as a camera and taking snapshots of each of the pages as you pass them. So you end up with thousands and thousands of pictures on your phone of pages. And then once you get home, you just have to kind of just start wading through them and taking out the most salient and most interesting and most historically significant points and trying to kind of batter them into a news story or into an analysis piece.
You don't have some clever PDF to text converter working there or anything like that?
No, just quick fingers. I'm kind of lucky that I touch type, because I think touch typing is a great skill for a journalist to have, because you can actually transfer stuff relatively quickly if you can type quickly.
I completely agree, and I deeply regret that I'm not able to do it myself. Jen, have you ever had this task in the past, or do you look forward to it in the future?
No, I've never had the task in the past, and I would actually look forward to it in the future. Harry's looking at me like, are you?
To give it to the old guys, I could actually, because it's 20 years now, so I can remember stuff that happened 20 years ago when I was actually working as a reporter. I came across my own byline on a number of occasions.
Harry?
Which kind of aged me a little bit. So I think they tend to give it to the more grizzled.
I wouldn't use the word grizzled, but I'd say now, In 6 years, I'll be 20 years. So I'll wait. Maybe in 6 years' time, they'll give me the job of. But no, I would love to do it. I love the idea of, like, I'm the kind of person who just loves to get stuck into. I know this sounds really boring, but like old records and stuff. I love poring over things like that and researching and stuff. So yeah, and I'm also supremely grateful to Harry for pretty much writing every paper over Christmas, so the rest of us didn't have to do too much work. So thanks, Harry. Appreciate that.
Well, Alison Healy and Peter Murta also did loads of work. And my favourite story of all was about the 1990 summit in Dublin Castle and Charlie Haughey giving out about the quality of the venison pate and describing the catering for all the European leaders as no better than pub grub.
And I'd say there's lots of people sitting over their Christmas dinner thinking the same about their duck pate. This is awful. This is worse than pub grub. Yeah, I totally agree with Charlie.
Dreadful venison pate. And of course he suggested that the catering people get Le Coq Hardy, which was the very posh restaurant that he was noted for spending many thousands of pounds in, to get them involved in the next dinner.
Yeah, only for the elite class, only for the leaders. And Aer Lingus Catering could do it for the rest. to give pub
nothing,
to the rest
nothing,
of those
nothing but the
attendance.
Best for Charles J. Hi, indeed, as always. Listen, we will leave it there. That's all for today. And thanks very much indeed to Jen and Harry. Also to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We're going to be back in your feed very soon. Do remember, you can contact us with your views or your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, goodbye and thanks very much for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taking to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.